Tomorrow night's Hanukkah, one more day, and to continue from our discussion last week, this is what we're going to say today is based on what we said last week, but an additional point. So we'll just kind of summarize last week's talk, and then we'll move on from there. Last week we discussed how, at a certain point in history, at the beginning of the Second Temple period, idolatry, the passion and lust that a person had for idolatry ended. The rabbis prayed that God should remove from us the lust for idolatry. God listened and that ended. At the same time, prophecy ended as well, which marked a point in the world where there was a disconnect in between this world and the spiritual worlds. When there was prophecy in the world, when there was this lust for idolatry, then we felt a connection to the more spiritual realm. It was much more intense, much more vivid, much more tangible. At a certain point, when God removed the passion for idolatry, he also removed the power of prophecy, and the world was kind of cut loose to some degree from the spiritual connection. That's the point when Alexander the Great came in and spread the Greek culture and Greek philosophy to the entire world. And the rabbis teach us that it goes together. That when Alexander the Great comes in, that's because there's no more prophecy and because there's no more idolatry, that has to be a new force in the world creating a challenge. That new force is the power of the human mind. The idea of Greek wisdom, Greek philosophy, Greek culture focusing on the human, very human-centered culture, the human mind, human success, what a human can produce, the human productivity, that all came from that point, Alexander the Great's conquest of the entire ancient world. We discussed last the story of Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Righteous, who was the Kohen Gadol at the beginning of the Second Temple period, and how the Talmud relates that Alexander came to conquer Jerusalem, and Shimon HaTzadik came out to try to dissuade him from conquering Jerusalem, and Alexander got off his chariot and bowed down to Shimon HaTzadik. And the rabbis describe, because Alexander had seen him in his dreams prior to winning battles, and he understood that he only existed and had power due to Shimon HaTzadik, due to Shimon HaTzadik's power, due to the power of the rabbis. And therefore Alexander the Great himself, the emperor of the entire world, the one who was the world power, he bowed down to the high priest, the Kohen Gadol Shimon HaTzadik. We discussed last week as well that meeting is such a central part of understanding the world this very day and understanding the Hanukkah story, because once the world is detached from prophecy and detached from idolatry, the next playing field is the playing field of the human mind, where we're focused not on the spiritual worlds with that direct connection, but the human mind trying to understand truth. Alexander the Great and Greek philosophy is the human mind understanding truth based on the human mind totally. What we understand, what we feel is true. What we can understand with our minds is not rational, it's not logical, it's not true. That's the perspective of a philosopher. That's how Nachmanides, the Ramban, described Aristotle, that he's somebody who only is willing to admit to truth of the truth of those things which he can understand with his human mind. But if he cannot sense it with his five senses or understand it through his own personal logic, then it can't be true. That was Aristotle. The Torah tells us something very different. The Torah tells us that the human mind is a very powerful tool. The human mind should be used in order to understand truth to the best of its ability. But ultimately, there is a realm of truth beyond the human mind, which comes from God, which is found in the Torah. And there are times where you're going to have to submit to the wisdom of God, even though it may not be rational in your mind. There's things which we cannot describe in human terms, things which can't be detected through science and through nature. And those things are found through the Torah. And that's how we're going to fight the power of Alexander the Great, the power of the Greek philosophers. So Shimon HaTzadik, who was the one to whom Alexander the Great bowed down to, he was the very first person quoted in the Mishnah. In the beginning of Pirkei Avos, so we go through a long list of rabbis and generations passing down the transmission of the Torah from Mount Sinai all the way through the generations. The very first person quoted as an individual is Shimon HaTzadik. He's the one who actually is able to say a statement, and his statements become Torah. They are put into Torah for all eternity because he's a human being, but because he spent so much time studying Torah, because he feared God and did his best to understand the truth of Torah, when he speaks, what comes out of his mouth is also words of Torah as well, which we'll try to elaborate on a little bit more. But Shimon HaTzadik is the one who represents the source, the roots of the oral tradition of rabbinic wisdom, and the way the rabbis developed the oral tradition from Mount Sinai. And Alexander the Great was that opposite power of somebody who spreads Greek culture, the culture of understanding that only what the human mind can understand is true. Anything supernatural, anything that can't be explained in human terms, through scientific experiment or mathematical equation, can't be true. So Shimon HaTzadik comes against that and says, no, there's wisdom of the Torah which goes far beyond that which the human mind can comprehend on its own. So that basically catches us up from last week's talk. The Gemara tells us in the Maseches Megillah, Tractate Megillah, it says that, you know, God sent many enemies against Jewish people. And every time we had an enemy, God gave us leaders and saviors to bring us out of trouble. So it says that God sent the Greeks, the Yavanim. This is the challenge of Hanukkah. And God sent, as saviors from that challenge, sent Shimon HaTzadik and the Hashmonai of the Maccabees. Those are the two groups of people that God sent to save us from the challenge of the Greeks. So we understand very well what the Maccabees represent. We'll discuss that more. But they were people who stood up physically and fought a battle to protect the Jewish tradition, to protect the Torah, to protect Jewish culture. Shimon HaTzadik lived decades before. He lived, I don't know the exact years, probably 60 or 70 years prior, maybe even more, to the actual rebellion of Hanukkah. But yet the rabbis tell us that his power is something which helps us fight the forces of the Greeks. So the question is, why is the power of Shimon HaTzadik something which helps us fight the forces of the Greeks? So Alexander brought this new worldview to the world. Alexander conquered essentially all of Europe. I believe even to Asia he went a little bit. He conquered Egypt, Syria. I think he went even further. I'm not really sure exactly how far he went. I guess eastward, not westward. Eastern Europe. Is that correct? Eastern Europe, I think. A large portion of Europe and Asia, we'll put it that way. And spread his culture and philosophy to that entire area of the world. Again, a large and powerful part of the entire world. This is a focus, as we said, on the human mind, human accomplishment, and really void of anything truly supernatural, spiritual. Even though we know that the Greeks, like we mentioned last week, had their gods, had their mythology, which you can still read about this very day in Greek works, but they were all the human-like gods. The gods were as human as they come, even worse than humans at times. But they're not ready to ascribe anything supernatural to the world, because they felt that the human mind has to understand everything. So we have to paint even the gods in our human terms. The Torah tells us about an infinite God, and the human mind can understand infinity. But we understand this infinite God is all-knowing, all-powerful. Whereas the Greeks, even when they were portraying their gods, they portrayed them in very human terms. So once prophecy ended, we have to start a new approach. Now we can no longer connect with God, you know, directly. We don't have that direct link where God will communicate with the prophet. So we have to now come from the other end. Until this point in history, God's message to this world came from above down to us. Now we have a new job. Our job is to begin from our end to understand God and understand the truth of the world. But how do we do that? The starting point is not the human mind. The starting point is the Torah. That's where it starts. God gave us the tool that from our end, we can accomplish understanding the truth of the universe, both spiritual and physical. And that tool is the Torah. Until this point, our job wasn't necessarily to understand it from the bottom up. It was from coming from the top down. In times of prophecy, it was a direct link from the top down. We had this influx of information and knowledge coming in from God. But at this point, after prophecy, we have to take it from the bottom up. Any human pursuit of knowledge, in general, always begins with some sort of assumptions, axioms, principles. We're talking about the laws of science. So any scientist who starts an experiment, he's not starting from square one. He hasn't reinvented the wheel every single time. But he starts with certain axioms which he's working with, certain laws which are already proven, certain principles which he's working with. And based on that, he moves on to understand something new. That's how scientists would work. Same thing with, you know, when we talk about a philosopher like Aristotle. So Aristotle, like we've mentioned before, he starts with those things his mind understands. And he's saying, you know, start from square one, what does my mind understand? What's rational to me? What's not rational to me? And I'm now going to build up a worldview based on all those things which make sense to me. Those are my axioms. And I would refer to those axioms as, you know, we call it like his lenses. You know, you wear glasses, and you look through the lenses, and you see the world in a certain way. So if your glasses are blue, the whole world looks blue. If your glasses are too strong, everything looks blurry. If your glasses are sunglasses, everything looks darker. The way you view the world is based, we'll call that the lens a person looks through the world to see. Yeah.
Rose-colored glasses.
Rose-colored glasses, right. Yeah, exactly. So that's how you view the world. So the philosopher views the world through the glasses of the human mind, human logic. And everything, the way I perceive every event which is out there is based on the axioms of the human mind, human logic, and that's which is rational and logical. What's the Torah view on how to view the world? Take a Torah scholar. So ideally, in Jewish life, we begin teaching a child Torah when they're very young. Says Pirkei Avos ben Chamish leMikra. 5-year-old starting to start studying the Chumash. He's already studying the Torah. Moose gets to 10, he's studying Mishnah. 15, he's studying Talmud. There's already a progression of how much Torah he studies. We teach a child the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, very early. We try to get a child already very, very versed in Torah knowledge from the start. And what does that do for the child? That builds up also some axioms for the child as well. The child then, when he's 5 years old and learning Chumash, so he's already building up a worldview based on the Torah, not based on his own personal mind and understanding. If he's fed Torah day in and day out during his formative years, so the way that the child perceives the world should be built on Torah perspectives, Torah ideals, and the Torah viewpoint. That's where it should come from. We're providing the child with lenses. His lenses, hopefully, will have it in the shades of Torah. So when he views the world, he's viewing it not through his own personal mind only, but looking at it through God's eyes. How would God view the situation? What does the Torah say about this? Is this right or wrong? Is it moral or immoral? Is this correct or incorrect? And that you can see that the purpose of studying Torah, the lens of a Jew, is to create perspectives. One purpose, at least, to create perspectives on life based on what God, how God would like you to feel to see life. So I just thought this right. Yeah, good. How God would like you to see life. So, just like we said, a scientist doing experiments, rightfully so, he's beginning with axioms based on what science has proven until this point in history. A Jew is supposed to be looking at life based on the axioms of the Torah, based on Torah knowledge. How would God like me to view the situation? Well, if I'm well versed in Torah, I'll be able to see the situation in that manner. If I'm not well versed in Torah, so then it's hard to know what God wants out of me here. I have to figure out. I'm figuring it out on my own with my own mind. So I'm not using God's mind to do it. Yeah, we have a very, very heavy stress on Torah study in Judaism. We look at Torah study as one of the primary mitzvahs. Children in schools spend much time studying Torah, yeshivas. Torah study is a major part of Jewish life. And there's many reasons for it, but one reason is this reason, that Torah study is not only an action. I've got to mention an isolated action. If somebody is going to eat matzah at the Seder, they've done an isolated action eating matzah, and that's done. Someone puts on a pair of tefillin, they put on the tefillin, it's done. Someone makes a bracha, the bracha is made, and it's over. But Torah study is supposed to train the mind to think in a divine way. So you're trying to let your mind absorb God's knowledge, God's ideals, God's perspectives, what God feels is right and wrong. And then when you view the world, you're viewing it with a new lens. You're viewing it in a different perspective. That's what Torah study does for a person. It changes a person's perspective. So sometimes things which the scientist or the philosopher will say are not rational, we cannot comprehend. The Torah says we have to understand it in that way anyways, because this is what God says is correct. And the deeper a person studies Torah, they connect to the higher and higher truths which science can never detect. A scientist will never ever detect a neshama. It's a spiritual concept, the scientist can't find it. The Torah says a person has a soul, we have a neshama, and the neshama impacts you. The neshama wants you to do certain things. I don't think a scientist will ever figure out why it is that God forbids us to eat meat and milk together. You know, maybe you'll find something, you know, some sort of health concern or something. Ultimately, it's not something that is detected through a scientific experiment. But God tells you, this is bad. Meat and milk together is a bad thing. It's forbidden. Why? That's Torah knowledge. That's not science. And somebody who's well-versed in Torah, so number one, they're going to see meat and milk as something bad. Not good, but bad. And number two, the more and more a person is versed in Torah, maybe that person will understand eventually why that is. The scientist won't, unless he's a religious scientist who studies Torah. But the secular scientist will never understand that, because it can't be detected through science. But those people, you take a Torah scholar who's studying Torah for many, many years, he'll tell you a reason why what he sees in terms of meat and milk being forbidden. Now, there may be many reasons, but there's a depth in Torah which a person can reach through years of Torah study, which will help us understand things the human mind itself could not have understood without the Torah, which are not rational, logical, or scientific. But the mind can get there if it's been absorbing Torah for many, many years. Again, with studying Torah correctly, with sincerity, with the fear of God, if you approach Torah that way, it changes a person's lenses. Yeah?
You gotta say studying it more the Orthodox way. I grew up Reform, and I think from what I heard, or even got conservative, oh, that was the old days. You don't have to do that now. That's rabbis teaching that.
Right. So I'm obviously coming from the Orthodox perspective. And saying that, you know, the we're looking at the Torah as something which is eternal every step of the way. Even the rabbinic literature is coming from eternal sources. You're asking the wrong person.
An overlap, but there's research been done about prayer and how people's lives have been longer. They've actually studied it.
Right. How it helps the person.
It's proven that people who pray or people who have been prayed by on behalf of them, they've lived longer lives.
Interesting, right? Maybe a person more relaxed that way. You can definitely come up with explanations. I mean, the Rambam tries very much to come up with rational explanations to many, many mitzvahs, as we've seen throughout the time in this class as well. But some mitzvahs, ultimately, we're not going to fully get the reason, but you can understand the mitzvah deeper and deeper as time goes on. But it requires approaching Torah with a reverence for the tradition, the reverence for the rabbis, and understanding that what the rabbis say carries within an eternal truth. And if you approach Torah that way, with the fear of God, based on the tradition and based on that reverence, so then you understand Torah deeper and deeper. And when you hear something like, well, that was then and this is now, I mean, that's totally counter to a mainstream Torah tradition from 2,000 years back, that's for sure. But this is the approach. And then as you absorb more Torah in your mind, you're going to learn how to see the world through the Torah perspective, which is God's perspective. This is how God would like a human being to be able to see the world. That's where it comes from. Let's go now to the philosophy of the Greeks. So the Greeks tell us we can comprehend the truth totally with our minds, and if our mind doesn't get it, it's not true. So our mind is not going to understand, let's take meat and milk, for an example. A human mind never is going to fully figure out what's wrong with a cheeseburger. What's so bad? We'll go organic meat, we'll get a low cholesterol cheese, we'll roast it on a George Foreman grill and take away all the fats. What could be so bad about a cheeseburger? The Torah will tell you that there's actual truth only comes through a mind which is soaked in the Torah, which has absorbed the Torah. But your mind will never reach 100% truth. Your mind can accomplish a lot on its own. Science has discovered incredible things. We have in front of us an iPad, or we have a laptop, whatever you have, an iPad. It's an amazing thing which science has discovered. Without Torah knowledge, pure science, incredible things. But science never hit everything. The Torah teaches you there's things that go far beyond the world of science, far beyond the world of ration and logic in the human mind, which can be only accessed through serious Torah study and through taking in the Torah with reverence and with that approach. And again, so the stress of Torah study in Jewish life is that, because we're training the mind, we're not just trying to get down the information, but it's also training the mind to see the world based on Torah. The Greeks denied this entire connection to the divine reality. They took on a more scientific, we'll call it a realist view, which says that they're willing to concede that there's a creator out there. We mentioned last week that even Aristotle himself was somewhat of a monotheist. I mean, he did believe in a creator and in a god. They did have, again, also they had their Greek gods as well. They agreed to some degree that there is something out there beyond this world. But they weren't willing to concede that divinity had anything to do with our world. They said that, God is there, we're here, our world's in a bubble, and our world is what we can see and what we can feel, we can understand, and everything divine is in a different realm, nothing to do with us. The rabbis tell us in the Midrash that what did the Greeks tell the Jews? When they came, they came into Jerusalem, they defiled the temple, they started forcing Jews to assimilate and to stop performing mitzvahs, take on Greek culture. And the rabbis have a quote. They said, the Greeks would tell the Jews, you should write for yourselves on the literally it says on the horn of a calf, on the horn of a cow, you have no portion in the God of Israel. So let's take that quote. They told the Jews, you have no portion in the God of Israel. Ein lechem chelek b'elokei Yisrael. You have no portion in the God of Israel. They didn't say there's no God of Israel. They didn't say there's no God. They didn't say you can't believe in God. They just said you don't have a portion in God, meaning you don't connect to God. There's no connection here. God has no way to connect to our world. You can talk about God all you want, but in terms of real life, it's not reality. Our real life is what we see within our world. And there could be God out there, but he's beyond us. He has nothing to do with us. The divine doesn't impact our actions, doesn't dictate right or wrong, doesn't impact our thoughts, doesn't impact what we should do. A scientist might believe in God, but that should not affect the scientific research. And anybody would agree to that. A scientist who's actually performing an experiment, he should never say, well, I'll just believe that this works. A scientist has to prove, based on facts and based on scientific method, that this is true. a believing scientist, even if he's a believer in God, there's many religious scientists out there, but when it comes down to their scientific experiment, they never resort to God as the answer to their experiment. That's not science. That's already religion. So the Greeks would say, you can be like a religious scientist. I mean, in life, you cannot resort to God for anything. Don't resort to God to answer any of your questions. Don't resort to things which are beyond the human mind. If you want to be a believer in God, that's great, but that's nothing to do with the practical world. That was the philosophy which the Greeks were trying to convince the Jews of. And those Jews who became Hellenized really took on that philosophy as well. Many Jews did become Hellenized at that point. They assimilated. We have a whole group of Jews referred to as the Misyavnim, those who had become no Greek, those Jews who had become like the Greeks. And they took on Greek culture, Greek philosophy, and they were acting as if God had no impact in their life. So the Greeks never had any problem with us believing in a God. They said, but why should that affect your actions? We don't understand. Why do you want to give a bris to this baby? It doesn't make any sense to us in our human mind. And maybe a doctor nowadays might tell you there's some health benefits to circumcision. I think there's a debate about that. But certainly in their days, they thought it was just defiling the body. It was barbaric. Why would you defile this beautiful baby's body? And we say, no. We call that beauty. A bris mila to us is the perfection of the baby boy. It's not a defilement. And the Greeks said, well, looks like a defilement to us. You're defiling the body. It doesn't make any sense. But so they said, in a practical world, you can't bring in supernatural concepts. You can't say, well, because God told us that a circumcision is beautiful, we should do it. This is not beautiful. Look at it. You're cutting the baby. That's what you're doing. So we say that's absolutely wrong. God enters our world. God has a connection to our world. Even after prophecy ended, even after the written Torah was completed, the final prophet died out, and there's no more prophecy in this world, and we don't see open miracles day in and day out. We don't deny the fact that God is involved in daily life in all aspects. God enters our world. God's involved in our world. God desires us to act in certain ways. God dictates right and wrong. And how do we know what God wants out of us? Through the Torah. The Torah teaches us that even though society might say that X is right and Y is wrong, the Torah might say that Y is right, X is wrong. Which does happen many times. You see many current events, and you'll see that what society proclaims to be good and correct, the Torah would say is forbidden and bad. And it comes up again time and time in history. And we say because God's desire, God's will does impact our life, God is here on a practical level, a day-to-day basis, there's right and wrong determined not only by the human mind, but by God. And I mean, just to take an example, you look at modern, you know, let's say, liberal ideas such as embracing homosexuality. Torah says that's a terrible crime, totally forbidden. A modern society says, what's the problem? You know, two consenting adults, they're nice people. Why is it? You know, I don't blame them. I from a human perspective, it's hard to find something really wrong with homosexuality. I think we can all concede that. You know, we might think it's strange, we might think, well, men and women are not created for that, but ultimately, nothing a human mind can really say is wrong about it, not evil. I mean, I don't blame people for saying it's correct, but the Torah tells us that it's forbidden. So the Torah tells us that there is something wrong with it. So then we can figure out why the Torah says such a thing. But that means that in God's ultimate truth, there is something wrong with homosexuality. That's the Torah tells us. And that's one example which is very pertinent nowadays, but it comes up time and time again. Society will say that this is correct, and it could be they're 100% right based on human values, but the godly perspective is that it's wrong. Now, we as Jews are now supposed to take the godly perspective and say, the Torah says that X is wrong. Now, the Torah scholar will sit back and think, well, let's understand why it's wrong. Because it is wrong. The axiom is this is wrong. Now, why is it wrong? And then you pick up your Gemara, you pick up the book you're studying, you talk to the rabbi, you think, you work at it, and try to figure out, well, let's understand the Torah's perspective. Why is it wrong? But why it's wrong according to the Torah is the ultimate truth. That's the truth of the world. And what the human mind dictates, that's something which may make sense to the human mind, but it's not true. Ultimately, it's not the truth of the world. And we can all think of many examples for this. That's because God's desire, God's definition of right and wrong, God's will impacts our life. We don't say that God's separate from us and God's up there and we're down here. We say that there's a divine spark in this world, that God enters into our world, God affects our world, and therefore what we do is impacted by God. That's the Torah perspective. When we talk about, we mentioned Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Righteous, the Kohen Gadol. He is one of the powers which helps us to fight against this Greek philosophy, Greek culture. And we said Shimon HaTzadik presents to us really the beginning of the development of the oral tradition after prophecy ended. Let's understand what that means for a second. Because if you look at the Mishnah, you look at the Talmud, and what is it? It's before, it's a lot of rabbis speaking, telling us their opinions, their thoughts, their philosophies, their take on what the Torah means. And one is very, it's very tempting, which people have done, which we mentioned before, to say that that's just what that rabbi thinks. But I think differently, you know? Rabbi Shimon says X, okay, but you know, he's a human being, he was a smart human being, he was a holy person, but you know, maybe he's wrong. And we have the right to say that about a human being. You're allowed to say human being is wrong. You know, we're all human, we make mistakes. And truth is, a rabbi in the Talmud can make a mistake as well. That's not something which is off the beaten path to say that a rabbi made a mistake in the Talmud. On the other hand, Torah Shebaal Peh is telling us the following. The oral tradition, the Mishnah, the Talmud, is the message that a human being can speak and create Torah. Meaning that Shimon HaTzadik in Pirkei Avos, as the first one speaking, he says a line in Pirkei Avos. He says that the world stands on three things: on Torah, on the service of God, and on acts of chesed, acts of kindness. That line is deemed to Torah of God. This is God's will, this is God's knowledge, this is God's wisdom to the world. It was said by a human being. Those words were never uttered to Moshe in the written Torah. A human being named Shimon HaTzadik said those words. But who was this human being, Shimon HaTzadik? He was somebody who was a link in the chain back to Mount Sinai. He was somebody who spent hours and hours a day, almost every day, every week, months, years studying the Torah. He had Torah soaked through his bones. He was totally absorbed in Torah. He's one who feared God. He was righteous. He was holy. He was moral. He did his best to be the best person he could be. And when his mind says something, when he speaks, we say that must be what God wants. That's God's will. That's God's message. Because a person who is so linked in to the tradition and to the Torah and to God and lives a life of goodness, of righteousness, and is somebody who is studying the Torah based on tradition, based on the tools God gave us in Mount Sinai, so what he produces is also deemed as Torah. So Shimon HaTzadik then is now a human being using the human mind, through human productivity, but creating something we would call Torah, the truth of Torah, Torah's Emes. It's true Torah that he's producing. And it's a very powerful concept because, I mean, the Talmud is if you look at the Talmud, so a lot of the Talmud is trying to understand what the actual text means. And that's one level of the Talmud. Part of the Talmud is rabbinic wisdom, rabbinic laws. And that's where really a major debate comes in terms of understanding the text. So most people don't have a problem with the fact that we understand what the text means, and this is our source as to what the text of the Torah means. But when you come into the world of rabbinic law and rabbinic wisdom, then why can't we say, well, that's what he thought then, this is what I think now? He's not trying to attribute it to any verse in the Torah. He's not trying to look and say, well, Moshe said this. He's trying to say, this is what I think. I think this should be a law, and this was deemed a law by the Sanhedrin. Why should I say this is God's will? And there's many answers to that question, but to me, one of the most powerful answers is because when a person of that caliber, who's absorbed the Torah for such a long period of his life, and is so righteous and so connected, and fears God to such an extent, speaks, he is speaking God's will. The Talmud tells us that even the chatter, it's the daily mundane talk of a Torah scholar is also considered Torah. Because when a Torah scholar speaks, we're assuming what they're saying is coming in some way from God's will. This is what God would want a person to do with the situation. A person who thinks through every action and sees the world with the divine lens. So even when they're talking about the weather, we say this is how a person talks about the weather. This is the right time to talk about the weather. This is the right time. This is when a person needs to have light conversation. This is how you speak. And you can learn something even from their idle, everyday, insignificant chatter when you look at a very, very great person. Even to this very day, you look at a very righteous person. You know, look at a Gadol Hador, one of the greatest sages of the generation. You watch how they act, even when they tell a joke, even when they're talking about seemingly mundane matters. But everything is calculated. Everything is, this is what God wants out of me at this moment, and therefore I'm going to do it. That's what's going through the person's mind. And we can learn from that. But the key to this is in the concept of the oral Torah. At Mount Sinai, God gave us two important parts of the Torah. We have the written Torah, the text, the five books of Moses, that text is from Mount Sinai. Also, in some way, which is a longer discussion, the text of the prophets as well was at Mount Sinai. Everything was at Mount Sinai. But also there's an oral tradition. It was never meant to be written down. It was meant to remain oral, passed from teacher to student for every generation. It remained 100% oral for a couple thousand years, the oral tradition. And that oral tradition was how to understand every part of the Torah beyond the text, because the text at times is vague. We don't know what it means. There's details which are missing, applications. Parts of life are not addressed in the text. There's gray areas. We have to know what it means. So God gave us an oral tradition, which consisted of knowledge of how to understand and explain even details of the text, but also gave us tools how to draw out more from the text. We have tools that we're supposed to use that God gave us, logical tools, which give us a right to draw out lessons from the text as well. And this remained oral for many, many generations until the Jews had reached a point where they're exiled and persecuted and they were forgetting their oral tradition. They had to write it down. And that was written down in the Mishnah and the Talmud. But until that point, it was totally oral. It was an oral tradition passed from teacher to student for generations. Now, what's one of the big differences between the oral Torah and the written Torah? I mean, God could have written everything down. It would have been long, but you know, we have a Talmud. I mean, we could have had a Torah scroll, which is much thicker. So, you know, we have the Talmud. There's 36 volumes of the Talmud, 36 tractates in the Talmud. There's more in the Mishnah. But God could have written all down, too. I mean, no reason not. But God wanted some to remain oral, some to remain written. So let's understand one of the powerful points about having an oral tradition. There's a story with Yanai HaMelech, King Yanai. Yanai was a king actually descended from the Maccabees, from the Hashmonaim. The truth is that the Maccabees had a very tragic ending. Because even though they're the heroes of the Hanukkah story, and they're very righteous people, their great-grandchildren, their grandchildren, great-grandchildren became Hellenized. They actually became what they fought against, their grandchildren became. It was a very terrible thing. They took on the leadership of the Jewish people. They became the king of the Jewish people. And they became Sadducees. They became Hellenized. And they eventually became heretical in many ways, their descendants. And they drove the Jewish people into destruction. And that led to the destruction of the Second Temple and the current exile that we're in right now after that destruction. It was their descendants. I mean, so we hold them up as the heroes of the Hanukkah, which they were. But their descendants really, you know, they led us down a very dark alley. So what happened was, in the times of King Yanai, who was one of the descendants of the Hashmonaim, of the Maccabees, he was a very wicked king. He decided he wanted to kill out all the Torah scholars. And he started picking up Torah scholars one by one. So they said to him, he's still Jewish. I mean, even the Jewish kings at those times, heretical, still had some reverence for the Torah. So they said to King Yanai, what's going to be with the Torah? If you kill out all the scholars, who's going to teach us Torah? So he said to them, well, what do you mean? The Torah's right there in the corner. If you want to go read the Torah, go pick it up and read it. You don't need the rabbis. That's what he said. So the Talmud says, at that point, we know that Yanai became a heretic because he denied the oral tradition. He said, the Torah is in that scroll over there. If you want to read the Torah, go read it yourself. What's the big deal? Pick up the book. What do you need this rabbi for? And what did he do? He denied the oral tradition. That's what he did at that point. He denied that the oral tradition carries any weight to it, has any importance. And the truth is that the major distinction between the oral tradition and the written Torah is that point. The written Torah is over there, but the oral tradition is inside the person. I mean, God wants the human being to become have a Torah perspective. A person, you know, to use the Yiddish term, become a Torah-dick person. A person who is, you know, a person who's absorbed Torah within themselves. If Torah remains in a book, so then you pick up the book and read it, and you put the book down, and you go off and do what you want to do. If the Torah is oral, it's in the person, so that is going to transform a person. You're supposed to have the Torah inside you to transform you. Oral tradition forces you to you yourself become a Torah shvul. You yourself become a container of Torah. So the rabbis who are part of the oral tradition, and Torah scholars this very day, they're not just reading a book, but they themselves are transforming into their own personal Torah scrolls. And the Talmud recites, it says, these Babylonians are so foolish. Because they stand up when the Torah scroll passes by, but not for the rabbis who walk by. And really, the rabbi who walks by is a walking Torah scroll. That's who he is. Why are you standing up for the Torah scroll, not for the rabbis? That's what the Talmud says. It says the Babylonians don't recognize the importance of the sage who's carrying Torah within himself. The key to the Jew fighting this Greek philosophy that God is totally disconnected from our world. We find that in the oral tradition, in the tradition of the rabbis, in rabbinic wisdom. Because that shows that the human being themselves can become divine. The human being, not divine in terms of being God, but divine, you can contain within yourself God's wisdom, God's knowledge. You can view the world not based on a scientific method, but based on divine lenses. You can put on glasses which you see the world through a Torah perspective. And God very much connects with our world. Shimon HaTzadik represents this as the first one to speak in the Mishnah. And his words become words of Torah for all generations. And it's also represented by the Maccabees themselves, the Hashmonaim. Because those Jews, they were Kohanim, the Maccabees. They were the priests, the children of Matasiah, Kohen Gadol. And they stood up to teach us this lesson. The Greeks said that you have to put aside your own personal beliefs and culture and actions, because, again, God is up there, you're down here, and he's irrelevant to you. They said, no way, we're Jews. We believe that God is in the world. God's very relevant to our lives. God dictates right and wrong, even though prophecy has ended, even though there has been a disconnect between the world and God. But still, God is here for us. God's part of our lives. And at that point, they're the ones who stand up and fight the battle. As many commentators point out, that they were Kohanim. They were priests, they were Kohanim. They used to serve in the temple. And the prophets tell us that the Kohen, he used to be the one who was a Torah teacher. It says in the verse, in the prophets, I can't remember which book it's in, but it says, Sitz Ekon Yishmeru Das, the lips of the Kohen will guard wisdom. The Torah of Hashem, Yivak Shem Epiyu, and you should seek the Torah of Hashem from his mouth. Meaning that the Kohen himself is the Torah teacher. He is the one in the line of the Torah tradition. And it says you seek it from his mouth. I mean, we're talking about Torah Shebaal Peh, oral tradition. You go to the mouth of the Kohen, the Torah teacher, and you seek Torah from his mouth, because he is the one who's supposed to stand in this link from Mount Sinai to us this very day, teach us the oral tradition, and he represents a human being who can become so sanctified that God has entered within him. He's absorbed the godliness, he's absorbed in himself the Torah wisdom. Now he can look at the world from that Torah perspective and teach us how to see the world through Torah lenses. So Hanukkah teaches us that even after the times of prophecy, even though Hanukkah occurs after the written Torah has been sealed off, Tanakh has ended. The last book of the Tanakh has been finished. Hanukkah is not found anywhere. There's no book in Tanakh that contains Hanukkah. The rabbis even say that Hanukkah is loaded in the custody. It's not supposed to be written down anywhere. Hanukkah is something which is supposed to remain oral. And it teaches us a very important lesson, which is that even after prophecy, even after the written Torah is completed, you can still find spirituality not only up there, but also down here. And you find that through, first and foremost, through Torah, the study of Torah, the Torah scholars. You find that through performance of mitzvahs. I mean, the Greeks came in, they wanted to stop us from performing mitzvahs. They stopped us from performing a bris, from keeping Shabbos, from having Rosh Chodesh, from the Jewish months. Those are the three main things mentioned. In addition to Torah study, in addition to other things as well, there are other things also mentioned in different sources. But they want to prevent some mitzvahs, because a mitzvah is trying to, when we do a mitzvah, what are we doing? We're trying to say that God desires this out of me. This is correct because God said so. That's what a mitzvah is. They said, what do you mean God said so? I don't understand it. That's not correct. What's correct is what I understand. The three primary things mentioned are Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, and Bris Milah. Those are the three primary things mentioned. The mitzvah of Hanukkah, the focus on Hanukkah is on the kindling of the menorah, the fire, basically a miracle which happened in the temple with the fire. But fire itself represents something much greater than fire. Fire represents the Shekhinah, the divine presence in the world. You find many sources for that throughout the Talmud, that fire represents the Shekhinah, even in the Torah itself, that God had a fire dwell upon the Mishkan at night. That represented the fire of God, God's presence dwelling in this world, the Shekhinah. And on Hanukkah, it says that the menorah of the temple, the Talmud tells us the menorah of the temple itself is supposed to be testimony to the world that the Shekhinah resides amongst the Jews. So the menorah itself in the temple, the menorah which the miracle happened on, that menorah which resided in the temple was supposed to be testimony to the world that the Shekhinah, that God's divine presence, rests on the Jewish people. Meaning that godliness could rest in this world. That's what that means. And the menorah itself presents that. The fire on the menorah presents God's divine Shekhinah, the divine presence in our world. So what happens on Hanukkah? On Hanukkah, we light in our homes the menorah. And just like the menorah in the temple is supposed to teach us that God rests upon the Jewish people, so the menorah on Hanukkah as well in our homes, we're showing that God rests in our homes as well. God's not out there. God's not up in the heavens. God's not only found in the shul either. God's also found in my home and everyone else's homes here. That's when you light the menorah in your home, you're performing the service of the temple in our own personal living room. That's what we're doing. Or dining room, or wherever you light your menorah. But what you're doing is you're showing that you can have a temple service, you can have spirituality, the divine presence, not only in the heavens, not only in the shul, not only in a Beis Medrash, but also in your own house. And that's what it teaches us. God could connect the human being with the world, in the Jewish home, and even after the destruction of the temple, after the times of prophecy, after the times of the written Torah, God's still there. The sparks of holiness of God are still in our lives, still in the world. Now, there's the Hasidic masters, different Hasidic rabbis, point out something very interesting, which is that one of the terms for the soul is a nefesh. Maybe a nefesh is a term for a soul. So the word nefesh could be looked at as an acronym for the three essential parts of an ancient lamp. You have the ner, which is the receptacle of the oil. You have the psila, which is the wick. And you have the shem, which is the oil. So nefesh, ner, psila, shemen. You have the receptacle, you have the wick, and you have the oil. So the human soul is compared to a candle, to a lamp. And we light our Hanukkah candles on Hanukkah, and we're showing how God's presence rests upon our world. Also, we know that God has his own candle. It says in the book of, I believe it's in Mishlei, it's in Proverbs, it says, Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam. The candle of God is the soul of the human being. So our soul is compared to a candle in that as well. And as we light our Hanukkah candles, which Hanukkah shows that there's a light in every Jewish home, we also have to know there's a light in every single Jew. That the Jewish soul is also considered a candle. And you know, God lights the Jewish soul up. We have the spark of divinity in ourselves. The Greek philosopher would tell you that, what do you mean there's no godliness in a person? There's no soul, there's no godliness. We're human beings, we have human minds, we do the best as human beings can get, but there's no divinity touching our world. The Jew says, absolutely not. That we have within us a divine spark, we have a soul. Our soul is compared to that candle. And as we light our Hanukkah candles, we're also focusing in on the candles in ourselves, in our souls, and understanding there's a fire in our soul as well, which burns on Hanukkah. Hanukkah shows us that even, and this is really one of the major messages of Hanukkah, that after all of the tragedy, after the fights, after the war, after prophecy, and even in the year, it's in the cold of the winter, as we've felt the past few days, you know, coldness, even in modern terms, he was very cold to me. It means there's a disconnect, there's a distance. It's in the dark of the night, the mitzvah. It's during the darkest times of year. Hanukkah always hovers around when you have the shortest day and the longest night of the year. It's always hovering around the solstice. And ultimately, what we're trying to say is that even as things look, as disconnected as you feel, as dark as it is, cold as it is, even though your past prophecy is after the destruction, the Jews are in exile, the temple's been defiled, still there's divine light in our lives. Still there's divine light in this world. God still connects. God never left. God's not only found up there, God's found down here. And the Jewish soul, which is also compared to a candle, is symbolized through the Hanukkah lights as well. We light the Hanukkah light in our home, God's in our home, and we should be thinking about our soul. We have a soul within, and God is the light of God is found in our soul. That's the message of Hanukkah. And this goes head up against the message of the Greeks, which is that the divine is up there, we're down here. If it's not rational, if we don't get it, then it can't exist, it's not true. And we say there's a lot of truth out there which the human mind will never understand if they do not resort to understanding God first, understanding the Torah first. And that's the Jewish philosophy. And just one last point. I always mention on Hanukkah, you know, Hanukkah, you know, as we have it, is one of those days where even the most assimilated Jew wants to identify. And we'll say the practical reason is because it's the season of the year. It's not Jewish holidays now, so the Jews want to grab onto their holidays as well, which I think is the practical reason. But again, God runs the world, and there's definitely always divine providence. And why it is that certain times of year, that even those assimilated Jews want to step forth and identify as Jews. So I believe that Hanukkah is that time. Number one, Hanukkah was a time where we were fighting against assimilation. That's what the Greeks were trying to assimilate. They didn't want to kill us. They wanted to assimilate us. That's what they wanted to do. So the victory of Hanukkah calls every assimilated Jew and says, there's a victory now against assimilation, so you're going to now step forth and identify. And they do. And a good percentage of Jews who don't identify as Jewish the rest of the year, when it comes to the, you know, the office holiday party, they're not going to go and celebrate Christmas. They're going to mention I'm Jewish and I can celebrate Hanukkah. That's what they're going to do. Because Hanukkah is a fight against assimilation, and therefore every Jew steps forth and says, I'm Jewish. But even more than that, if the light of Hanukkah represents the flame in a Jewish soul, every Jewish soul is compared to a candle. Even the assimilated Jew has a soul, has a Jewish soul, compared to that candle. And as we kindle the Hanukkah lights, there's that spark in every Jewish soul, which also is being kindled. And it drives them to want to come back and identify as Jews. So there's no coincidences. So yes, the time of year itself lends to people identifying with their religions. But ultimately, why does God have Hanukkah? I mean, things could have happened differently. Maybe the things could happen around Pesach time or something, or Sukkot. But Hanukkah is the Yom Tov, which tells us that we're fighting assimilation. Every Jew, deep within, has that spark, that Jewish soul, which is compared to a candle. That fire is still there. And when you have a fire going, you can always fuel the fire to get bigger and bigger. So Hanukkah is a time where, I guess, it fuels the fire, even though it's assimilated Jew, and they step forth and at least they identify. And it's even very assimilated Jews will still light their menorah and identify as Jews around Hanukkah time. So I find that to be the power of Hanukkah, and it ties in the whole idea that as dark as things can be for Jewish people, there's never are we extinguished. God's presence is always there, whether it be on an individual basis, on a historical basis, on a national basis. But as dark as things are, as distant as things are, as far as a Jew goes, they can never escape. And God is always there with us. The soul is there. God's presence is there. And, you know, people don't realize this, that the battle of the Maccabees, the story of Hanukkah, it did not end in such a happy manner. The war was, I think, about 25 years long. The Hanukkah miracle happened, I think, more towards the beginning of the war. They went on fighting for long time after that. Most of the Maccabees were killed during the war. I mean, the five leaders, the five sons of Matthisiahu, I think 4 out of 5 died during the war, 3 out of 5, 4 out of 5 died during the war. It was not so rosy, as I said before. And as time went on, like we mentioned, their grandchildren became assimilated into Greek, you know, into Greek philosophy. They became wicked and heretical. Really, the descendants of the Maccabees led the Jews to destruction. It was not a pretty sight, even though we celebrate it. Because what are we celebrating? But we're celebrating that as dark as things are, and as distant as things look, and as bleak as the world seems to be, Hashem is there with us anyways. So even for this family that was fighting a war, and very heroically, and they all died out, they still saw the miracle. They saw the miracle of the lights in the temple. They saw the miracle of winning over this huge army. And their descendants also, you know, we looking back at their descendants, we said even these people who had such terrible descendants were still able to bring us to miraculous salvation. Because God is there for every Jew, always. God is always coming through our world, and that spark is always burning no matter what. So we shall have a happy Hanukkah. And, yeah.